All Bones Considered, Laurel Hill Stories number 61 for April 2024. Play Ball, Part 3. Four more Laurel Hill baseball pioneers. Slick Schlichter, Cub Stricker, Jack McFetridge, and Pete Childs. East is a National Historic Landmark, an arboretum, a sculpture garden, a nature preserve, and an active cemetery in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It opened in 1836 and remains a popular visiting spot for tens of thousands of visitors every year. Its sister cemetery, Laurel Hill West, located across the Schuylkill River in Bala Cynwyd, was founded in 1869. It has a history and a population of its own. I am Dr. Joe Lex, retired professor of emergency medicine at Temple University in Philadelphia, volunteer tour guide at Laurel Hill East and Laurel Hill West, and volunteer podcaster. April, baseball season is upon us once again. I've done two prior episodes of Play Ball, former baseball players interred at Laurel Hill East or Laurel Hill West. In November of 2019, All Bones Considered number 7, I talked about Harry Wright, the father of baseball, Ben Scheib and Al Reach, sporting goods manufacturers who founded the Athletics, Harry Callis, who was the voice of the Phillies for decades. Part 2 of Play Ball was October of 2021, All Bones Considered number 31. Then I told you about Wes Icicle Fissler, who scored the first run in Major League history, and Lon Knight, who threw the first pitch in Major League history, although he's now in an unmarked grave. Harry Luff, a bad man who skipped from league to league to avoid the law, and Orator Schaefer, who still holds the Major League record for most assists by an outfielder in one season. It's time for part 3, and yes, there will be at least a part 4 and possibly a part 5. Rachel Walgamuth keeps finding baseball players for me at Laurel Hill West. Today, four more men who played our national pastime but are only vaguely remembered today. Henry Walter Slick Schlichter started as a bantamweight boxer and a boxing promoter. He became a sports writer, and then he partnered with black baseball pioneer Saul White to organize the best Negro League team in the country at the turn of the 20th century. Fortunately, Phil Williams of the Society for American Baseball Research gave me about 90% of what I needed to do that script. Cub Stricker was a good fielding second baseman with a hot temper, who was arrested on the field to avoid fan rioting when he struck a heckler with a thrown baseball. Jack McFetridge was the best amateur pitcher in Philadelphia for years. And when he finally went pro, it turns out he wasn't that good. David Nemec wrote his story for the Society for American Baseball Research a few years ago, and I'm using it primarily for my script. Pete Childs was a fine second baseman and served in that role for the 1902 Phillies. It was while he was player manager for an Ohio League team that he pulled the unfathomable feat of throwing one pitch as a reliever and getting three outs. I had planned to talk about Francis Richter, who is enshrined in the Baseball Hall of Fame, but I will save him for a later podcast. These four men I'm talking about today were born within about a 10-year time span. Three are interred at Laurel Hill West, one at Laurel Hill East. They are featured in this month's episode of All Bones Considered, Laurel Hill Stories number 61, for April 2024. Play Ball, Part 3. Four more Laurel Hill baseball pioneers. This essay was mostly researched and written by Phil Williams for the Society of American Baseball Research. From 1902 through 1911, Walter Schlichter owned the Philadelphia Giants, the finest African-American team of the era. Schlichter was white. The Philadelphia Items sporting editor, and had previously managed boxers, not ballplayers. Yet, with Negro League player and pioneer King Solomon Sol White, he formed a persevering, successful partnership. Competition, alignment with more powerful forces, an ill-advised secondary baseball venture, and finally a break with White spelled the end of the Giants' predominance. Schlichter returned to sports writing, where he played a critical role in breaking the Black Sox scandal. Henry Walter Schlichter was born 1 March 1866 in Philadelphia. His parents, Henry and Tamsin nee Breidenbach Schlichter, were of established German-American stock. Census records suggest several siblings. His brother Elmer later joined him on the Items sports writing staff. His father worked as a hotel keeper. After a sickly childhood, Schlichter joined Philadelphia's Schuylkill Navy Athletic Club as a young adult. In 1889, he won the club's cross-country race. In 1890, in the ring, he was runner-up in the Mid-Atlantic AAU Bantamweight class. Schlichter also joined the Item that year, where he soon became the sporting editor. Known throughout Philadelphia's athletic community as Slick Schlichter, he sponsored football clubs, organized swim meets, announced track and field events, and oversaw cyclist competitions. But his heart belonged to boxing, a sport that was transitioning from its brawling, bare-knuckled past to a commercialized, gloved future. Schlichter's active days as, quote, a hard scientific puncher, end quote, soon faded. By the end of the decade, he was established as a referee of recognized ability and a popular manager of boxing affairs. In February 1898, he married Mary McAllister. Soon afterwards, his friend Thomas Akins presented the bride with a portrait entitled Maybelle. Schlichter occasionally took Akins to local fights. And in April 1889, the painter witnessed his friend referee a bout between Charlie McKeever and Jack Daly. Afterwards, Akins posed the three principals separately in his studio. The resulting work, Taking the Count, remains a masterful depiction of American sporting life. In its serene depiction of a violent bout, Schlichter occupies the center of the painting, attentive only to the fallen and dazed Daly. Schlichter seemed poised to emerge as a leading force in boxing. He managed Philadelphian Martin Judge, who gallantly but unsuccessfully fought Baltimorean Joe Gans three times in 1899. In January 1902, while managing the Penn Athletic Club, Schlichter arranged a February fight between lightweight champion Frank Erna and Gans. Yet New York promoters squeezed him out of his club role, and Erna backed out of the fight. The reset Erna-Gans showdown, sans Schlichter, occurred that May in Ontario. Gans KO'd Erna to become the first African-American boxing champion. On 28 October 1902, The item reported that, quote, a new colored baseball team had been organized with headquarters in Philadelphia, end quote, and that these, quote, giants will be under the captaincy and management of Saul White, end quote. This was only the latest iteration of an established brand. A black Giants baseball club played intermittently in Philadelphia in the 1880s and 1890s. In July 1901, Gans briefly operated the Philadelphia Giants squad in Baltimore. On the Giants' reemergence, White wrote in 1907 that, quote, Harry Smith, baseball writer of the Philadelphia Tribune, it's an African-American newspaper, conceived the idea of a professional team to represent Philadelphia, end quote. White also later wrote of how Schlichter arranged a 30 September 1901 exhibition game between the all-black Cuban ex-Giants and the Philadelphia Athletics at the latter's Columbia Park. The item significantly promoted this match beforehand, and only about 1,670 people attended the game, which ended in a 4-4 tie after 11 innings. But the mostly African-American crowd was quite enthusiastic. The match, White maintained, drove Schlichter's ambitions to organize a black team. Schlichter's boxing background served him well in independent baseball. He knew how to schedule, he knew how to negotiate cash guarantees and gate shares, sustain a network, practice publicity. Moreover, while racism was plentiful in boxing, its color line was not as pronounced as baseball's. Schlichter and black boxers developed lasting professional relationships. Gans, for example, would write letters to Schlichter on his upcoming bouts to be published in the item. White not only managed, captained, and played, but also scouted and determined the roster, as a general manager would. He also aided with business management. Schlichter only occasionally accompanied the team on the road, leaving Saul White to serve as, quote, traveling secretary and sometimes booker, end quote. The era's racism determined that a white owner had greater access to capital resources and other white power brokers. Yet throughout baseball history, many a successful owner has granted a talented general manager free rein. The relationship between Schlichter and White was grounded in mutual respect. The owner later stated, Saul White was one of the brainiest baseball players and managers that ever put on a spiked shoe. Whereas the player-manager GM later observed of Schlichter, he was as shrewd as you could make him. White played with the Cuban ex-Giants, who are often called the Cubes by contemporaries, for most of the previous half-dozen seasons. He signed many of their stars for the Philadelphia Giants, who were also referred to as the Phillies. That means that the Philadelphia Phillies were in the National League at this time. So there was a white Phillies in the National League, and then there was a black Phillies that was a freelance team that would play pretty much anybody they could set up a game with and get paid. On 23 April 1902, these Phillies walloped Camden City 12-4. By 8 September, this squad possessed a 70-33-2 record. But Schlichter could not entice the Cubs owner, Ed Lamar, to a series between their teams. Instead, the Cubs enticed Williams and Hill to jump pack. Financially, it was bust, White later wrote of the Phillies' debut season, claiming both he and Schlichter lost money. Otherwise, it was a grand success. That offseason, Schlichter and White abandoned the cooperative payment plan where dividends were distributed to players on an often uneven basis based on owner-determined profits. Instead, as White later recalled, quote, we copied a big league contract which called for a 10-day notice of release and salaries the 1st and the 15th of every month. These salaries ranged from $60 to $90 per month in 1903. White took considerable pride in this pay structure's implementation. It likely proved a selling point in his recruiting. Now, players, once recruited, needed to be retained. To this end, Schlichter enrolled the Phillies, again, this is the Black Phillies, into the first of a dizzying sequence of leagues they would join in the coming years. The newly formed National League of Independent Baseball Clubs. The purpose of the NLIBC, the item asserted, was to prevent players from jumping their contracts. But more than anything else, better gates allowed the Phillies to turn the corner. In 1902, they apparently played only two games in the New York City market, where the ability of independent teams, black or white, to skirt laws prohibiting Sunday baseball made for lucrative opportunities. In 1903, the Phillies played at least 10 games in the New York metropolitan area against white teams. These appearances began with a wild Sunday victory, 16-12, over Ridgewood on 19 April, with 10,000 people in the stand. Two Sundays later, against Hoboken, in front of 6,000, they faced semi-pro ace Ernie Lindemann for the first time. Behind Carter, Philadelphia triumphed 7-3. They also cracked the Atlantic City resort market with three summertime appearances. These Phillies impressed onlookers, as fine a semi-professional team as there is in the country, and in big league class. All that awaited was a showdown with the Cubes. Schlichter announced the details in July. Seven-game series that September, with a substantial side bet between him and Lamar, and an agreement that, quote, the winning team will take 60% of the gross receipts and the losers 40%, end quote. With Monroe injured and the Phillies unable to solve Andrew Rube Foster's pitching, the Cubes took the series. As the 1903 season wound down, Schlichter filed articles of incorporation for the Philadelphia Giants Baseball and Athletic Association in Washington, D.C. With himself as president, capital stock was listed at $20,000. The incorporation papers were notarized in Pennsylvania on 25 April 1904. And that July, three Phillies threw no-hitters. Kid Carter versus Atlantic City on July 9th, Will Horn against Oxford, Pennsylvania on July 12th, and Foster versus Trenton YMCA on July 25th. In September, the Phillies avenged themselves on the Cubs and they took a three-game series. Schlichter likely was not free of his era's prejudices. The item occasionally printed racist caricatures of black athletes that his sporting editor, he probably could have disapproved. Yet in at least one instance, Schlichter objected to advancing Jim Crow norms. In 1903, he refused to pay a hotel keeper a fee after the proprietor forced the Phillies to change in a stable rather than in the hotel. After the 1904 season, he lobbied the independent Tri-State League to accept the Phillies, but the color line held. Quote, it was admitted that the Philadelphia aggregation was a good drawing card, a Harrisburg reporter noted, but it was thought best that they be kept out of the league. In 1905, the Phillies, White later stated, fielded, quote, one of the greatest lineups that ever composed a colored baseball team, end quote. Lefty Dan McClellan and teenaged Emmett Bowen joined the pitching staff, and with Rube Foster formed a trio of 30-game winners. Veteran Grant Home Run Johnson arrived, and indeed, he led the squad with 12 home runs. Frank Grant, Pete Hill, Bill Monroe all contributed memorable campaigns, and these Phillies finished the season with a 128-23-3 record. Now, by now, called a trust, Schlichter and Strong formed a booking agency in early 1906. They announced they would schedule all games for the Phillies, Royals, all Cubans, and several white independents. In practice, it seems Strong increasingly arranged the Phillies' weekend matches in the New York market, leaving less profitable games to Schlichter. Slick Schlichter eventually went broke trying to run an independent black baseball team. When he cut salaries for certain Phillies after the 1906 campaign, capped meal allowances, forced players to provide their own uniforms, Slick's former player Rube Foster took a critical step, and he became a magnet himself. Quote, he called several of the players of the Philadelphia Giants together and told them, while his contract or salary had not been reduced, he did not think they were being treated fairly, and they were going to starve trying to better themselves, adding that he would guarantee their salaries, offered by Philly management, and place a team in Chicago. An interviewer later wrote, Foster, along with Philly infielders Nate Harris and Harry Moore, joined that city's Leland Giants. Rube Foster, of course, is in the Baseball Hall of Fame. In 1907, Saul White, who's also in the Hall of Fame, authored and Schlichter edited and published Saul White's Official Baseball Guide, a landmark black baseball book. White also reloaded with two talented youngsters that season, shortstop John Henry Lloyd and catcher Bruce Petway. According to a Jersey City correspondent, the Phillies proved, quote, the strongest team on the independent circuit, end quote, and rolled to the initial National Association crown. After the season, Pete Hill and several other Phillies left for Cuba to continue their baseball livelihoods. Meanwhile, Schlichter rubbed shoulders with major league magnates at the National League meetings, quote, looking for protection for his colored stars, end quote. When Hill returned, he joined Foster in Chicago. Throughout the Phillies' glory years, Schlichter continued as the item's sporting editor. A sensationalistic evening paper, it claimed more than 200,000 readers. Slick remained a regional boxing fixture. He assisted in organizing Philadelphia's first automobile show, and he soon helped to launch its runner's marathon. In December 1907, the White Union League of Professional Baseball Clubs of America was launched. Don't confuse this with the Union Association of several years earlier. Its founder, the Union League's founder, was Alfred Lawson, former major leaguer and future visionary, or con man, depending on your perspective. Lawson was also elected the circuit's president. Schlichter backed its Philadelphia team, which he would also manage. Lawson claimed this enterprise was, quote, organized on a basis which makes it as strong as the Rock of Gibraltar, end quote, and that it would content itself, quote, merely to do business on an independent scale, unquote, instead of poaching contracted players from organized baseball. Schlichter incorporated his union's club, heavily promoted it within the item, and oversaw construction of its West Philadelphia grounds. Yet the Union League had been launched in a recession, and its talent-poor product failed to attract fans. Schlichter quickly sought to ease out of managing. On 20 May, with a record of 6-14, he handed the reins over to Ernest Landgraf. 2 weeks later, the Union League collapsed, and Lawson filed for bankruptcy. Following this campaign, Schlichter and Saul White split. White revived the Philadelphia Quaker Giants. Schlichter promptly ensured that White's Quakers would be ignored by the International League of Colored Baseball Clubs of America and Cuba. This was the successor to the National Association. Ray Wilson took over the Phillies' field operations. With veterans like Dan McClellan and Wilson, youngsters like John Henry Lloyd, Bruce Petway, Frank Duncan, Spotswood Poles, the team remained formidable. In August, they took 2 of 3 against the Lelands. Yet, as a Binghamton correspondent opined, the Philadelphia Giants are not in the same class as ballplayers as either the Brooklyn Royal Giants or the Cuban Giants, and lacking the fun, end quote. Those teams did provide crowds. Notices of Philly's open dates appeared in the item, and the team eventually finished well out of the 1909 International League pennant race. That offseason, Lloyd, Duncan, and Petway joined the Lelands. The Phillies continued for another 2 seasons with marginal success and erratic fan support. 2 young stars, catcher Louis Santop and pitcher Dick Redding, suddenly defected in July 1911. And on the first day of August, Schlichter disbanded the team. Mary Schlichter died in 1913. They had had no children together. And by that time, Walter was no longer managing fights, but he instead dabbled in vaudeville. He was booking vaudeville. And it's likely that he met his second wife, actress Margaret Grace, that's G-R-A-Y-C-E, through the stage. Her stage name was Peggy O'Neill. He remained a Philadelphia sports writer, still focused upon boxing. Sometime before the item folded in 1915, Schlichter joined the Record. He then landed at the North American, where he played a pivotal role in unmasking the Black Sox scandal. This tale began early in the century when Schlichter managed fight cards in which boxer Billy Maharg appeared. Years later, Maharg was one of several principals who met with 7 White Sox players immediately before the 1919 World Series and arranged a fix. By late September 2020, fueled by lingering suspicions and concerns over gambling's influences, a grand jury was convened in Chicago to investigate the 1919 World Series. Its proceedings were brazenly open to and reported by the press. At some point, likely as these headlines spilled out, Maharg met with Schlichter. Maharg may have been motivated by the $10,000 reward Sox owner Charles Comiskey offered for evidence regarding his players' participation in throwing the World Series. After hearing Maharg's story, Schlichter informed his colleague and North American sporting editor James Isiminger. And on 27 September, Isiminger interviewed Maharg himself. The next day, his story headlined the North American's front page. Schlichter's role was unmentioned within. Now, by that point, no one else directly involved with the fix had publicly come forward with details. The grand jury in Chicago had decided not to call any of the players associated with the scandal, and the White Sox were in the middle of trying to overtake the Indians for a second straight pennant. But within 24 hours of Isiminger's expose, Eddie Seacott and Joe Jackson confessed, and the grand jury issued indictments. Schlichter, after the Black Sox scandal, continued with the North American until it folded in 1925. The Inquirer then hired him. By 1941, although his output had been sporadic for years, he was heralded as the oldest sports writer in America. On 15 January 1944, Walter Slick Schlichter died of pneumonia and complications after a fall in Philadelphia. He was 78 years old. Margaret had died in 1942. Neither of his marriages produced any children. He was interred at Laurel Hill West in the Rockland section. There is no marker. There has never been a marker. In his Inquirer obituary, for the first time, Schlichter's role in the Black Sox scandal was detailed. It was, the writer suggested, quote, the highlight of his career, end quote. His ownership of one of Philadelphia's greatest baseball teams and one of the greatest Negro teams of all time was mentioned only in passing. Here is a dilemma that contemporary baseball players probably don't have to worry about. In 1893, the Philadelphia Phillies were a powerhouse team in the National League. They averaged 7.6 runs per game that season, second only to the Boston Bean Eaters, who scored 7.69. The lowly Washington Senators, spared from last place by the even more hapless Louisville Eclipse, showed up for a midsummer match on August 2nd. The series had been moved from Washington for financial reasons. The change of venue did not help the visitors. They lost the first two games, 22-7 and 14-7. Now, playing second base for the Sad Sack Senators was Philadelphia-born John M. Streicher. He was playing under the name of Cub Streicher. The moniker Cub came from the infielder's rather diminutive height of 5 feet 3 inches. Now, for the next few minutes, I will read to you from the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer for the next day, August 6th, 1883. Headline: A Baseball Row and Cushion Fight. There were lively times on the Philadelphia ball ground at Broad and Huntington Streets yesterday afternoon, and the windup was a grand battle of cushions, which was participated in by several hundred men and boys, and which was witnessed by 10,000 spectators. Like all baseball crowds, the one which assembled yesterday was very lively. Every seat on the right and left bleachers and in the big pavilion was filled, and the people stretched along the terrace from the left field seats to the Broad Street fence. The excitement started with the game. The slugging done by the Phillies tickled the crowd, and they hurrahed and shouted to their heart's content for three innings, during which the home team rolled up 11 runs. Then the Senators changed pitchers, and in the next two innings, the Phillies only made one run. In the sixth, Harry Wright's boys hit the ball on the nose again, and the Senators played as though their hands were full of grease. This combination gave the Phillies seven more runs, and the excitement rose to a fever pitch. The last man to go out in the sixth inning was Sherratt. He popped up a little fly, which fell in short right field. Little Cub Streicher, who learned to play ball at the old horse market ground at 24th and Ridge Avenue, ran out and made a nice catch of the ball. The crowd in the right field bleachers shouted at Cub and tried to make him maul the ball, but he held on to it. And then Streicher said something to the bleachers, and the latter answered back. Cub drew back his right arm and threw the ball in the direction of the right field seats. The ball struck the bicycle path and bounded into the bleachers, striking a young man named William Wright of 1805 South 15th Street in the face. Wright was lifted from the crowd, supported by two policemen, and led under the pavilion, where an examination showed that his nose was broken. Stricker's action and the sight of the wounded man raised the indignation of the crowd, and for the next 5 minutes, pandemonium ensued. "Arrest him! Take him out of the game!" called the crowd. And when umpire McQuaid and Sergeant Charles Egolf went toward the little second baseman, a shout of joy went up. But Cub wasn't arrested then or put out of the game. But every time after that, when Streicher went after the ball, and twice when he came up to bat and was put out, he was hooted vigorously. "We'll fix you after the game," the right field bleachers yelled to Streicher repeatedly. And after that, Cub kept very quiet on the players' bench. When the Washington went to bat for the last time, Sergeant Egolf arrested Streicher, and taking him out under the pavilion, conducted him to the 22nd District Station House at Broad and Lehigh Avenue. The threats made by the crowd made Sergeant Egolf take this action. He was fearful that if he did not get Stricker away before the crowd broke loose after the game, a riot would take place. The crowd shouted its approval over Stricker's arrest, and the cause of the trouble being removed, quietness was restored for a while. But then another complication arose. The Senators had won out, and Ball was on third. Sullivan lifted a long fly ball to left. Delahanty made a splendid running catch of the hit, sent the ball sailing into Clements. It was a close race between Senator Maul and the ball, but the Senator won by about 2 inches. The crowd, however, was under the impressions that a double play had been made and that the game was over, and the people surged over the field in diamond from all directions. It was a shouting, howling mob, and there were only 4 policemen to control it. The crowd couldn't get back at first, and Captain O'Rourke of the Washington Club wanted umpire McQuaid to give him the game because they could not play. At this critical juncture, manager Harry Wright came on the field and said, "Gentlemen, if you don't get back, we will lose the game." Those few words acted like a charm. And the crowd moved back until they were clear of the base and foul lines. Paul Radford was sent to first base on balls. And then the Senators were in a dilemma. It was Stricker's turn to bat. He was locked up a square away. If Stockdale batted out of turn, Stricker would be declared out for not taking his turn at the bat. O'Rourke was scratching his head over this difficult problem when clever Paul Radford solved it by running down to second base and, oops, being put out stealing. The game was over. That ended the game, but not the fun. For scarcely had the players left the field before the cushion fight began, and for the next 20 minutes, the air was full of flying cushions. The thickest of the fight was on the right side of the pavilion. A number of men and boys in the pavilion began the battle by throwing the cushions into the crowd that was surging across the field. The latter threw the cushions back and then stormed the stand. The fight was carried to the upper part of the pavilion, and after it was over, several hundred cushions were lying at the foot of the stairs on the Huntington Street side. The battle was so fierce and the struggle so great that the heavy railing in front of the pavilion was pulled out of place, and at one time 40 men and boys were clinging to it. It looked as if it would fall. Had it fallen, many would have been injured and some might have been killed. The battle ended when the participants became exhausted. What this front page article failed to provide was the final score. It was 21 runs and 37 hits for the Phillies, 8 runs for the Senators. In that 3-game series, they had outscored their opponent 57-22. John A. Stricker was born 8 June 1859 in Philadelphia. He was the youngest of 6 children. His father, William, worked in an iron forge. His mother, Rachel, was a housewife. John did not go to college, and he started his professional baseball career in 1882 with the Athletics. He had a solid, if unspectacular, rookie season. He batted .217, no home runs, 18 RBIs, 34 runs scored. He even served as a relief pitcher for 7 innings and had a notable ERA of 1.29. Stricker improved significantly in his sophomore year. This time, batted .273 with 1 home run and 40 RBIs in 89 games. The Athletics won the American Association pennant. Stricker stayed with them through 85 before he joined the Atlantas of the Class B Southern Association. The Atlanta Constitution reported that Cub was, quote, unquestionably the best second baseman ever seen in Atlanta. Cub was at second base when the Atlantis became the first team to play a game without committing an error. From 1887 to 1889, Cub played for the Cleveland Blues of the American Association, which moved to the National League and became the Spiders. So when Cleveland visited Philadelphia on 14 June 1887, Philadelphia fans showed their love for Cub with a standing ovation and a basket of flowers with an eagle on top. When the Players League was being formed in 1890, Stricker was tempted to jump ship to the Cleveland Infants, but the Spiders sued him, declared that the reserve clause in his contract bound him to them. Cub fought that case, and he was allowed to change teams, but the Boston Globe referred to him during the season as, quote, one of the most outspoken brotherhood players in the country, end quote. He was an early proponent of unionization. Cub Stricker continued to drift through a fairly long career in pro ball. When the American Association went out of business after the 1891 season, he was assigned to the St. Louis Browns, where he was named the team captain. He lasted only 23 games with the team and was stripped of his captaincy after he jumped into the stands and punched a fan who'd been heckling the team. He was quickly traded to the Pirates for pitcher Pud Galvin, but he never played a game for Pittsburgh. He was almost immediately traded to the Baltimore Orioles for pitcher William Adonis Terry. The Orioles finished in dead last, 54 and a half games behind the pennant-winning Boston Bean Eaters. A lowlight of that season occurred in August in the reading room of the team hotel in Boston. Cub and outfielder William Jocko Halligan had been good-naturedly ribbing each other until Halligan left the room, returned, and without warning, sucker-punched Stricker in the face. Stricker had a fractured cheekbone, which kept him out of the lineup for one game. Halligan was suspended without pay for the rest of the season. It was during this time in Washington that Cub had the difficulties with the fan in the stadium in Philadelphia. In late October, the case went before Philadelphia's Common Pleas Court, and it turned out Cub's victim was not exactly a model citizen. The charges were dropped. Stricker was not petitioned for any court costs. Cub bounced around numerous semi-professional teams for the next few years. When he was released by Providence in 1896, he caught on with Pottsville of the Pennsylvania State League. Among the competition for the Pottsville Colts, the Hazleton Quakers, that's Quaykers, I wonder if that's contribute to Matthew Quay. The Carbondale Anthracites, the Lancaster Chicks, the Allentown Goobers, did not make that up, the Harrisburg Senators, the Reading Actives, and the Shenandoah Huns. Toward the end of the season, he played for another team in Norristown, Pennsylvania, and in Cumberland. Throughout his career, Stricker was well known for bunting as a place hitter and for his speed in completing double plays. He was also notorious for convincing umpires to call a runner out despite only having bluffed a tag. After one game where four visiting runners had been called out going to second base, when, quote, to everybody in the stands, it looked like Cub never even got within 10 feet of the man, end quote, Stricker was asked how many of the runners he actually touched. He replied, what's the use of touching him and running the risk of getting spiked? All you have to do is make a pass at him and then roll the ball back to the pitcher. Honest, there ain't an umpire in the league who can see further than his nose. Stricker worked as a milk wagon driver during the off-season for a number of years during his playing days and continued to do so even after he left professional baseball. The 1910 census lists Stricker as a real estate agent. In 1890, at age 30, he married a woman named Hannah, who was 12 years older than him. Stricker and Hannah had no children. They lived in Huntington Pike, Rock Ledge, Pennsylvania. cub, had more than 5,000 plate appearances in his peripatetic 11-year career and more than 1,100 hits. His final batting average was .239. Never a power hitter. He only had a dozen homers in his career. He was a little speedster, though. He stole 278 bases. Cub Stricker, or John A. Stricker, died at age 77 on 19 November 1937 from a combination of bronchopneumonia, generalized arteriosclerosis, and myocardial degeneration. He's buried at Laurel Hill West in the Stricker family plot, as is Hannah, who died from a cerebral hemorrhage at the age of 90 on January 26, 1939. Their names, however, are not to be found anywhere on the stone. We have got a lot coming up in April, both live and virtual, live at both cemeteries. Listen to this. Starting Sunday, April 7th, from 1 until 3 p.m., the Spring Arbor Tour of Laurel Hill West. Beautiful blooms. And that will be repeated on Sunday up April 21st at Laurel Hill East, from 1 until 3 p.m. Beautiful Blooms, Spring Arbor Tour of Laurel Hill East. I'm giving a virtual tour Tuesday, April 9th from 6:30 until 8. It is pay what you wish. I wish you would pay something, donate for this. I have put in dozens of hours on this, but I'm really proud of it. It is a virtual tour of people painted by Thomas Aikens, who were buried in Laurel Hill East and Laurel Hill West. I've got a couple of dozen people that Aikens painted that I'm going to tell you about. Rich Boardman, one of our senior guides, is giving a hotspots tour at Laurel Hill East on Saturday, April 15th from 10 until noon. And then the big one, Sunday, April 14th, 1 until 4 p.m. What a day. Unsinkable to unthinkable. Titanic Passengers of Laurel Hill by Laura Lewis. At Laurel Hill East, we have the bodies of three survivors. We have the body of one who went down with the ship. And we have cenotaphs for two. And then over at Laurel Hill West, we have six survivors. It is an epic, epic tour. Highly recommended. Saturday, April 20th, from 1 until 3 p.m., Liberty or Death, Revolutionary War Soldiers of Laurel Hill East. That is by Russ Dodge. There's a Boneyard Bookworms on Thursday, April 25th, from 6 until 7 p.m. The April book discussion is The Swimmers by Julie Otsuka. And then the last weekend, listen to this. This is really crammed. Friday, April 26th, 10 until noon, Hotspots, Bill Linhart. That's at Laurel Hill East. April 27th, Saturday, starts at 9 in the morning with a City Nature Challenge in the green section at Laurel Hill West. That goes from 9 until 11:30. And while that's going on, there's also a Sacred Spaces and Storied Places tour that starts at 10 that Joan Zubris will be doing. And then in the afternoon at 4 o'clock, Two Gods Film Screening and Discussion. And I did not put down whether that's at East or West, so I apologize. I'll leave that to you to look up. And then finally, if you got kids that you're trying to get interested in the cemetery, here is your chance. Our resident winged fairy, Guinevere Eckert, is doing a tour for tiny taffs. Taff is short for taffophile. And that is for children, Sunday, April 28th, from 1 until 2:30 p.m. That ought to be a real treat. Okay, that's what's happening at the cemetery. Let's get back to the podcast. This article was mostly written by David Niemek for the Society for American Baseball Research. Jack McFetridge did not have to play baseball. He was a gentleman. the eldest son of wealthy lithographer John Reed McFetridge, Sr., 1844 to 1903, was partner with William M. Burke, 1857 to 1905, in the printing firm of Burke and McFetridge. The company produced lithographic trade cards, advertisements, book illustrations, pamphlets, calendars, and other printing-related material between 1877 and 1900. Burke and McFetridge had initially been colleagues at the Inquirer printing office at 304 Chestnut Street, where Burke worked as the printer and foreman, and McFetridge was a stamp agent. They purchased the printing house next door to the newspaper from William W. Harding in 1877. The Burke and McFetridge partnership operated from the second and fourth floor of the building until relocating next door to 306-308 Chestnut Street in 1884. In 1893, the firm incorporated and was renamed Burke and McFetridge Company. By 1898, the firm advertised they employed 110 hands, one of whom, 2 years later, caused an investigation by creditors as a result of the embezzlement of funds from the company. The company had total assets valued at between $400,000 and $500,000 at the time. And subsequently, 3 months after the inquiry, John R. McFetridge withdrew from the firm and legally filed to incorporate a new printing and publishing establishment under the name John R. McFetridge and Sons. McFetridge Sr. died suddenly in Atlantic City, New Jersey in 1903, and Burke not long after in 1905. John R. McFetridge and Sons remained in operation until at least 1945. John McFetridge Jr., whom everyone called Jack, was born 25 August 1869. He holds the dubious record for the longest gap between his first and second major league seasons of any player who debuted in the 19th century. Nearly 13 full years elapsed between his initial pitching appearance with the Phillies in 1890 and his next sighting in Phil's garb in an official National League game in 1903. Now, Jack McFetridge was catching people's eyes while he pitched with various amateur teams around town. He first spurned an offer from Jimmy Williams to turn professional with the Cleveland American Association Club at age 18 in 1888. McFetridge was pitching for the amateur Wynwood Club of Philadelphia at the time. But later that season, he agreed to practice with the Philadelphia National League Club. 2 years later, he was with the amateur Highland team of Gloucester, New Jersey, when Harry Wright finally convinced him to pitch an official game for Wright's Philadelphia Nationals. Actually, Wright probably convinced McFetridge's father, since in the days following his superb debut against Brooklyn, the Sporting News reported, "For all practical purposes, McFetridge's trial amounted to nothing, as his father has absolutely refused to permit the boy, who is a minor, to play professional ball." Yet, some 2 months later, the 6-foot-tall, 175-pound McFetridge was no longer a minor, but he continued to disdain all offers to turn pro. McFetridge's trial took place in the second game of a doubleheader at Philadelphia on Saturday, June 7th, 1890. The same day, Sporting Life informed its readers he might indeed, quote, try his skill against professionals, end quote, that very afternoon. And he produced a 4-1 complete game win over Dave Fouts of the pennant-bound Brooklyn Bridegrooms, in which the young amateur went 3-for-4 in his own behalf. The following Saturday, Sporting Life offered this depiction of the contest. In the second game, on June 7th, the Phillies put in the crack local amateur pitcher McFetridge of the Wynwoods, and he made the most successful debut that ever befell a young pitcher. His speed was great, command perfect, and his nerve phenomenal. The Brooklyns could do nothing with him and got but 5 hits in the game. Making McFetridge's major league intro all the more impressive was that his catcher was Jack Clements, already notorious by 1890 for his recalcitrance, which on occasion boiled over into contempt when he was called upon to handle a novice hurler. Clemens no doubt regarded the 20-year-old scion of a wealthy family as haughty in addition to undeserving of the opportunity to pitch a game for the Phils, especially when they were in hot pennant contention at the time. To add insult to Clemens' ego, on September 5th, the Phillies faced McFetridge, who by then had joined the Riverton Amateur Club, located in southern New Jersey. This was an exhibition game, and McFetridge trimmed the National Leaguers 8-7. He would have won with ease, according to Sporting Life, had he not hurt his hand in the 7th inning and be forced to let up in his pitching, allowing the Phils to score 5 runs in the final 2 frames. McFetridge's catcher that day was Lou Graff, who also got into a lone 19th-century Major League game in 1890 with Syracuse of the American Association. And except for 1891, when he played in the Pacific Northwest League, Graff remained McFetridge's catcher throughout most of his lengthy stay with the Rivertons. Riverton had an active amateur team from back in the 1870s. In 1891, when Harry Wright had severe pitching woes after his pre-1890 ace Charlie Buffington skipped from the disbanded Philadelphia Players League club to the Boston American Association entry rather than rejoin Wright's brood, the Sporting News claimed that the local press clamored for McFetridge to be signed, but he and Phil's co-owner John I. Rogers had a major falling out. In any event, McFetridge again spent the summer months with the Riverton Nine, which by then also featured his brother Tom, a second baseman, and remained with the club when it participated in indoor winter competition. Another item, Sporting News, 19 December, 1891, reemphasized he would never, under any circumstances, turn pro because his parents were wealthy and forbade him in no uncertain terms to play for pay. Meanwhile, McFetridge continued to dominate the amateur ranks in the Philadelphia area while attending the University of Pennsylvania and pitching for the school's team in spring months. In 1893, after the February 11th edition of the Sporting News announced that Jack Fetridge of the Rivertons has got his grit back again, Lippincott's magazine, in its August issue, printed an illustration of him in a feature story on leading amateur players. 3 years later, Jack McFetridge is still considered the top amateur pitcher in the Philadelphia area, and he frequently hooked up in duels with the Orange Athletic Club's ace, Hyler Vestervelt, in perhaps the most memorable such battle on Memorial Day in 1896. He was caught by Graff, who got Riverton's only hit in a 1-0 loss to the former Giants hurler. On 10 July 1897, McFetridge, although still with the New Jersey Rivertons, hurled for the All-Philadelphia team that topped an Australian touring team at the Phillies Park. The following year, McFetridge's father's company was engulfed by that embezzlement scandal, and that forced the older McFetridge to withdraw from the firm and go into his business on his own as John R. McFetridge and Sons. As late as 1901, the Phillies were still wooing McFetridge in vain, although manager Bill Schetzlein did induce him to pitch an occasional exhibition game for the Phils without a contract. Finally, 1903, McFetridge weakened in his resolve and agreed to test his mettle for an entire season against National League hitters. Now, by then, he was 34. His age may have been against him. Or it may have been that he was never really that good to begin with pitching against amateurs. But the largest stumbling block, in all probability, was the fact that McFetridge appears to have never had so much as a single day of minor league experience before he bounced from the amateur Sandlots to the professional Phillies. He made his 20th century professional debut in the Phillies' third game of the season and the second game of a doubleheader at Boston, and he lost 4-3 to the Bean Eaters' Togi Pittenger. McFetridge suffered a ruder fate in his next start 8 days later. He was belted hard in a 12-7 loss to the Giants at the Polo Grounds. In his first game on the mound at his home park on May 4th, he was presented with a diamond link buttons by admirers and then lost 5-1 to Pittsburgh's Deacon Philippe. Although McFetridge was on the Phillies club all season, he was only given 14 starts by manager Chief Zimmer, quite likely because he lost all but one of them. Sporting Life attested that he was sick much of the summer, perhaps at least in part over the loss of his 59-year-old father on June 5th when McFetridge Sr. was found dead in bed, asphyxiated by gas from a broken fixture at his Atlantic City summer cottage, which had not yet been opened for the season. Only a 10-4 victory on September 19th over Cincinnati's Rip Reagan, who was making his initial major league appearance, saved McFetridge from finishing 0-11 and setting what would then have been a new major league season record for the most losses without a win. The mark at the time was 10. It was set in 1890 by Bill Stucker of the Philadelphia American Association entry. Little more than a week later, in the second game of a twin bill at St. Louis, McFetridge was caught by Frank Roth and performed credibly at his big league finale, only losing by a 5-3 count to the Cardinals' future Hall of Famer, Three Finger Brown. His 1-11 record, nonetheless, tied Washington's Happy Townsend for the worst in the majors that season. So the amateur got to the professional level and he failed miserably. He was also an outstanding billiards player. McFetridge continued to pitch in the semi-pro ranks until August 1907, and something we'll probably never know for certain, prompted him to return to pro ball with the last place Wilmington Peaches of the Class B Tri-State League. Now, one person surmises he probably knew Mike Grady, by then was the player-manager of the Peaches, and a fellow Philadelphian. After a successful trial against the Lancaster Club on August 26th, the day after he turned 37, McFetridge was, quote, signed immediately after the game, end quote, according to Sporting Life. In the short time left before the Tri-State League season closed, he posted a 2-1 ledger in 3 starts, and was impressive enough that Grady reserved him for the 1908 campaign. That fall, however, Jack McFetridge broke his kneecap while he was playing in a pickup football game with neighborhood teenagers. This brought an abrupt end to all his athletic endeavors, except billiards. Less than a year later, a Philadelphia writer noted in Sporting Life's September 5th issue, before the accident, McFetridge was one of the finest looking men in this city and might have posed a physical model for a sculptor. His accident, however, has made him look prematurely old, and had it not been for the musical sound of his voice as he met me, I might have passed him without recognition. It is Hamlet who says to Horatio, go tell my lady that were the paint on her face an inch thick, to this she must come at last. Jack McFetridge's obituary in Sporting Life states that he died at his home in Glen Olden, Pennsylvania on 10 January 1917. 47 years old, heart attack brought on by acute indigestion. Remarkably, despite all the attention he received in the Philadelphia press for well over a decade, there was never a mention of which arm he favored when he pitched. But Fettridge is buried in his family plot in the south section of Laurel Hill East Cemetery in Philadelphia. On 18 June 1910, the Portsmouth Cobblers of the Ohio State League were losing to the Marion Diggers 4-3 when the Diggers came to bat in the bottom of the eighth. The Ohio State League was a minor league baseball team. It operated in various seasons between 1887 and 1947, predominantly as a Class D level team. There were many league franchises based in Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, of course, and West Virginia. In 1910, it was rather small. The other four league teams were the Lima Cigar Makers, the Newark Nukes, the Lancaster Lynx, and the Chillicothe Infants. Portsmouth pitcher Frank Harter was struggling. He gave up four hits and hit a batter. To add to his misery, the Cobblers committed an error. Three runs scored, the bases were loaded, nobody's out. With his team down 7-3, a local newspaper covering the game said the manager and second baseman, Pete Childs, saw that Harter had nothing left to give. But Childs had no relief pitcher. He shrugged, and he took the ball from Harter, whom he sent to field second base. Franklin Pierce Harter did later pitch parts of three seasons in the majors with the Reds and the Hoosiers. Childs took a deep breath and flung the ball toward home plate, where Diggers outfielder William Colligan connected and sent it sailing toward the fence. All three runners took off. The Portsmouth Evening Times described what happened. Quote, Colligan smashed the first ball to the fence in center field, and Portsmouth's Frank O'Day went up against the fence and made the catch with one hand. Emmett Turk Riley had gone to second, and August Gus Epler counted from third. O'Day hit the cutoff man, Wesley Horning, who threw to first to put out Riley, who stood on second with teammate Al Hummel. And first baseman William Scudder threw to third base Ed Conwell for the triple play. All right, to summarize, in what must be the most efficient relief pitcher effort in organized baseball, Pete Childs threw one pitch and he got three men out. Despite the triple play, Childs Cobblers dropped a doubleheader that day, but they did go on to win the Ohio State League championship with a pretty decent 86-52 record. During his five seasons as Portsmouth's manager, Pete Childs won three championships. Childs spent most of his playing career and all of his managing career in the minor leagues. He only spent 2 years in the majors. And doing research on him is maddeningly complex. All right, let me explain. When Peter Pierre Childs signed on with the 1901 National League Chicago Orphans, that's just before they became the Cubs, he replaced a man named Clarence Lemuel Childs. This Childs was somewhat cherubic in appearance. He had acquired the nickname Cupid. Now, through the years, I have found some newspaper, actually several newspaper articles, that have confused the two. I found one article from 1912 with the headline, Reminiscences of Old Pete Childs, Former Jag Star, with the opening sentence, Many are the stories told about the late Cupid Childs. Two different people. But another 1912 article has the headline, Pete Childs, Old Jag, Dying in Baltimore. And it calls him a shortstop. He was not a shortstop. He was a second baseman. Philadelphia's Pete Childs lived until 1922, but Cupid Childs died in Baltimore in November 1912. And in 1942, there was another article that muddied the waters by calling him Pete Pierre Cupid Childs. Took a while to get this sorted out. Now, if that's not enough confusion for you, let me introduce you to Pierce Childs, C-H-I-L-E-S, as opposed to D-S. Pierce was a reprobate from Missouri who broke into the pros briefly in 1899 as a 33-year-old rookie with the Athletics. His nickname soon became, "What's the Use?" Most sports writers of the period were understandably flummoxed and started interchangeably referring to Pierce Childs as Pete Childs or Pete Childs, and occasionally Pierce Childs, P-I-E-R-C-E, as opposed to P-E-A-R-C-E. There were about six different spellings for three different people. This Childs was in constant trouble with the law, including a statutory rape charge. Maybe it was a combination of boredom and his instinct for larceny sent him with teammate Morgan Murphy to devise a totally illegal plan to steal the opposing catcher's signals. This is a technique that came to light one September afternoon against Cincinnati. Went like this. Childs was coaching at third base. This is Pierce Childs. This is not our Pete Childs. Childs was coaching at third base. He had noted that the team clubhouse was behind the center field wall, and he figured there had to be a direct line of vision to home plate. He sent Murphy behind the center field wall with a spyglass. He would see the signal that the opposing catcher gave the pitcher, fastball, curveball, and he would relay the signal to Childs via an electrical signal over a wire that extended from Murphy to the third base coaching box. There, it was barely exposed. The ground was always damp around this area. People wonder why there was always a puddle around this area. And when Murphy hit the button, it would give Childs a little shock. And then Childs would give a prearranged hand signal to the batter. Observers remarked that Childs had a strange leg twitch when he coached. So all was explained when Red shortstop Tommy Corcoran stopped the game and found the buzzer device under Childs' foot with the assistance of the umpire and the police. But Hall of Famer Christy Mathewson's made a careless error in his 1912 book, Pitching in a Pinch, when he accused the innocent Cupid Childs, not Pierce Childs, of the scene-stealing scheme. And in a 1911 article entitled The Athletics Do Not Guess the Plays, there's yet another discussion of sign-stealing, which the article states, quote, "The signal-tipping business dates back to the days of Pete Childs, who will be remembered by the fans of the State League. Childs' reputation, it seems, was not of the best when he broke into the big leagues, joining Philadelphia of the National League." They're talking about Pierce Childs. They're not talking about Pete Childs. Because this article describes Morgan Murphy stealing the signs and relaying them to Childs through an electric wire. Morgan Murphy and Pete Childs never played together. So once again, a sports writer has confused the names. And then to add insult to injury, Pete's obituary in the Inquirer gave the wrong year that he played with the Phillies. I hope that I sorted that out because it was very confusing to me. But then I've got to admit there's not a whole lot about Pete Childs out there. Even SABRE, the Society for American Baseball Research, does not have a biography for him. Although it has nice write-ups on both Pierce Childs and Cupid Childs, who probably should be in the Hall of Fame when you look at Cupid Childs' statistics. Peter Pierre Childs was born in Philadelphia, November 1871, to Peter P. Childs and Mary Landis Barkey. I find nothing about his upbringing, his education, or even when he started to play baseball. His playing size, 5'7", 175 pounds. He threw right. We don't know which side he batted from. The earliest mention I can find of him is June 1897 in an Atlantic League game. The Atlantic League, which lasted from 1896 to 1900, at this time consisted of the Hartford Bluebirds, Lancaster Maroons, Newark Colts, Norfolk Jewels, Patterson Silkweavers, Philadelphia Athletics, this is before the American League was formed, the Reading Coal Heavers, and the Richmond Bluebirds. The article read, "For the Athletics, reliable Pete Childs did some nice fielding." He batted seventh in the order. He was hitless in three at-bats with three outs, four assists, and one error, and Lancaster creamed their Philadelphia visitors 9-1. In 1897, he had switched to the Hartford Bluebirds. While there, Sporting Life magazine reported, "Pete was not heralded as a hitter, but he's lining them out quite regularly and playing the second cushion a good deal better than it has ever been played by any previous guardian of the bag in this town." 3 years later, Pete is second baseman for the Utica Pentups in the New York State League, including teams like the Cortland Wagon Makers, Rome Romans, Schenectady Electricians, Albany Senators, Binghamton Crickets, Troy Washerwomen, and the Oswego Grays. He had apparently come there from a team in Reading, which I can find nothing about. The article that I had said, quote, "Pete is always on the move and a man who covers a wide area of territory. He is one of the best infielders I know of in judging ground balls," end quote. 1901, Pete Childs was signed by a major league team, the St. Louis Cardinals, who had changed their name from the Perfectas only 2 years earlier. He lasted 29 games with the Cards. He batted a respectable .266, but he was released on 16 July. The next day, he headed north a few hundred miles, signed onto the Chicago National League team, which was in the midst of changing its name from the Remnants to the Orphans. The name Cubs came a few years later. Pete Childs took over second base from Cupid Childs, and in 60 games, he batted .229 with five doubles, one triple, and four stolen bases. A local writer commented, "Pete Childs is the best thing in a fielding sense Chicago has had since the days of Fred Pfeffer. It is a mystery how a man who moves so fast after a grounder can move so slow in going down to first. It is probable that motionless Pete stands on his heels when batting, and that he thus heaves a mound of earth under his hoofs, blocking his passage when he scoots and materially jarring his batting average." He left Chicago at the end of the season. He was soon replaced by an up-and-coming second sacker named Frank Evers, who soon connected with shortstop Joe Tinker and first baseman Frank Chance to form one of the best-known double play combinations of the dead ball era. 19 March 1902, Pete Childs was signed by the Philadelphia Phillies. He played 123 games for them. He made 78 hits, and he fielded 945. 36 errors and 656 chances. His name occasionally popped up in the sports pages, although he seems to have played a rather uneventful season. After a year in his hometown, Pete signed on with Louisville for the next season, and he spent the rest of his career as a manager or a player manager. In his truncated major league career, Pete Childs came to bat 692 times and had 147 hits for an unimpressive batting average of .212 and a puny slugging average of .231. He scored 60 times and drove in 47 runs. Along the way, he married Ella Florence Homeyard, and in May 1913, they had a daughter, Helen Margaret Childs, who grew up to marry Christian Herman Flaumer. From 1908, Scranton newspaper, "Pete Childs, the veteran second sacker of the Jags, has made a request for his release. Pete would like to get down and out of the state league so that he could manage and play on a fast semi-professional team in Philadelphia. Pete's home is in the Quaker City. It's noted that he managed the Kansas City American Association Club, pennant winners in 1913, and then he retired from baseball. The Jags, by the way, were not short for Jaguars. Although that was the mascot, it was the Johnstown Amsterdam Gloversville team in the New York State League, same place that he played years before. But in the brief time that he played for them, their opponents included the Birmingham Bingos, the Albany Senators, the Wilkes-Barre Barons, the Elmira Colonels, and the Utica Utes. When Peter Pierre Childs quietly retired to Philadelphia, he ran a cigar store and he lived in a relative comfort from his baseball earnings. As one article put it, quote, "Pete has played baseball for years and has always received good pay, and he's one of those players who knew to salt the mazuma when there was plenty of it in sight," end quote. He almost immediately got involved in an old-timers game in which a fellow Laurel Hill West residents, Cub Stricker and Taylor Schaefer, were involved. Whoever writes his biography for Saber is warned. There are many twists to this story. To summarize, Pete Childs was an average-size, good-field, no-hit second baseman who made a fairly decent living as a player, manager, and coach in baseball leagues all over the eastern part of the country for more than 25 years, despite spending only two of them in the majors. He followed the money, and he retired a comfortable man. Pete died of cirrhosis at his home at 2528 West York in Philadelphia in February 1918 at 50 years. He is interred in the Rockland section of Laurel Hill West, and that story about the one-pitch triple play ought to live forever. Mid-April edition of Biographical Bites from Bala, Laurel Hill West Stories. We are heading to Hollywood in the 1920s during the heyday of fan magazines, and one of the most popular magazine columnists of the day, Gladys Hall, who published dozens of interviews with movie stars in the early days of the silver screen. Gladys is indeed buried at Laurel Hill West. The May 2024 episode of All Bones Considered Laurel Hill Stories is about four popular Philadelphia-based magazines. I've already talked about Ladies' Home Journal, Saturday Evening Post, and the Saturday Courier in earlier podcasts. Now it's time to look at three popular magazines from the 19th century, Graham's, Peterson's, and Lippincott's, and one from the 20th century, Philadelphia Magazine. Laurel Hill East is located at 3822 Ridge Avenue in the East Falls section of Philadelphia. It's an easy walk from the bus stop at Ridge and Allegheny for SEPTA buses R1 and 61. Admission is free, as is parking in the lot across the street, although spaces are very limited. There's an app you can download for a self-guided tour through its 78 acres. Laurel Hill West is at 225 Belmont Avenue in Ballachinwood, with parking at the main entrance and at the bell tower. Your best bet for public transportation, SEPTA Regional Rail to Manayunk, or one of the many buses to the Wissahickon Transfer Center on Ridge Avenue. Cross the Schuylkill River on the Pencoyd Pedestrian Bridge, come up the Writers Ferry Road, and it is up, it's uphill, to the entrance near the Pet Cemetery. If you download the audios I've done for self-guided tours for West, each of them will lead you to a 40 to 45 minute audio tour. It talks about the people interred along the route through the cemetery. Both Laurel Hill East and Laurel Hill West are currently open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. We welcome dog walkers, bike riders, skateboarders, photographers, painters, bird watchers, tree and plant lovers. We welcome everybody. Just be nice. That's what we ask. If you follow us on Instagram and Facebook, you will get a daily reminder of some of our inhabitants and activities. You can also follow All Bones Considered on Instagram and Facebook and TikTok. And once you've fallen in love with these hotspots, become a friend of Laurel Hill. And then you have the opportunity for several members-only special tours conducted each year. And that includes some inside the mausoleum tours. They may be cemeteries, but they're a couple of the liveliest spots in town. The key to finding the gift shop online is to click on Support and then find the gift shop in the left-hand column. Our theme song, Names at Peace, was written and performed by local artist James Harrow. All Bones Considered, Laurel Hill Stories, and Biographical Bites from Bala, Laurel Hill West Stories, are mostly researched, written, narrated, and produced by me, Joe Lex, retired professor of emergency medicine at Temple University, whom you can reach through my email. This is different now. It's jrlexjr1947@gmail.com. Somehow my joe@joelex.net has disappeared. Remember to keep body and soul together until next time on All Bones Considered, Laurel Hill Stories, where the plot thickens. Stick around to hear the references that I used for this podcast. And until the next time we meet, stay safe, stay well. For Walter Schlichter, the script was based on an essay that was researched and written by Phil Williams for the Society for American Baseball Research. I added a few things also. I did some independent research, but I'm going to say 85-90% of what I told you came from that Sabre article. Cub Stricker, some stuff came from Sabre, but mostly I took that from the original baseball articles in the Sporting Life and where was the other one? Oh, from the Inquirer from 1893 when he got into the fight, when he threw the baseball into the stand and broke a fan's nose. That did not go over well with the other fans. Jack McFetridge also had a really nice Sabre article that was written by David Nemec, N-E-M-E-C. I got some other information about his father, but most of the baseball information about Jack came from that Sabre article. And Pete Childs, the work was mine. I had to piece through a couple of dozen newspaper articles trying to figure out which was Pete Childs, which was Cupid Childs, which was Pierce Childs. It was very, very confusing. I hope I got it all straightened out. Okay, so that is April for All Bones Considered. I hope you enjoyed it. Get in touch with me if you like. Leave us a review. And be prepared. I got more stuff coming up over the next several weeks. And please, please come out to the cemetery in April. It's a gorgeous time of year, and there are some phenomenal tours coming up. Stay safe, stay well.